And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, data show that retail investors are getting in on the rally, with new accounts surging at some popular brokerages. We talked to the head of investment strategy at one of the leading ETF providers about how their products are being used to play the market. Plus, there have been some major moves in the FX markets, particularly as dollar-yen breaks out of a multi-year trend.
And Sarah, I've been meaning to ask you, do you think we should once again do the craziest thing I saw in markets at the end of the show?
I do think we should do it at the end of the show. Why?
How
why
do you feel
all
about
of a sudden
that?
Change? I feel
okay.
good about it.
I just
it.
Want to make sure you're on board with it, you know.
I'm scared.
You kind of have a you have kind of a losing streak going.
And okay, first of all, I don't have a losing streak going. I would even say that I came prepared. We had a couple listeners who really came out of the woods in this last week to really hit on Mike. For one, we had a comment from Corman134 who said, "Like the Yankees, I'm always rooting against Mike." So, Mike, not everyone's on your side, particularly not me and not Corman134.
Corman134, whoever you are. I am like the Yankees of the craziest thing. But as you know, the crazy things in markets are one of my passions. And as you also know, another very big interest in mine is leveraged ETFs. We've talked about this before. I'm fascinated by them. So we have a great guest this week to discuss them with us. His name is Simeon Hyman. He's the head of investment strategy at ProShares. Simeon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us this week, first time on the show, is Bloomberg's own Rachel Evans. She's a managing editor, covered ETFs for a long time, now shifting focus a little bit to bonds and FX, but still one of our in-house ETF gurus who we're happy to have on the show.
Good to be here.
All right. Simeon, let's start with you. I do want to get into sort of what's going on in the leveraged ETF space, but one of my favorite ProShares ETFs has got to be PAWZ, P-A-W-Z. And this is from the owner of a Golden Doodle. You know, a neighbor of ours got a Golden Doodle in Metuchen, New Jersey. Then we got one. And then next thing you know, they're all over Metuchen.
We had a Labradoodle 15 years ago. He's 15 years old now. He's still hanging in there. But we were before you.
way ahead of me, of course. But Simeon, talk to us about the PAWZ ETF, just the rationale behind it. I know, you know, it buys pet store companies, pet medicine companies. I'm fascinated by this ETF. Talk to us a little bit about how it came about and sort of what the reaction has been.
Sure. Yeah, the ticker's PAWZ, and yes, we do pride ourselves on clever tickers.
That's a good one.
So this one counts as a clever ticker. But look, we look at themes all the time, and I think the challenge when you look for themes is you got to find where money's really being made. So here, there's real money being made. And anybody who has had to take care of their dog or even, you know, God forbid, have to actually have serious health issues with their dogs know how expensive it can be. And also the trends towards premiumization and humanization. I mean, right now, there are more households in the U.S. with pets than there are children. And the spending has been incredibly robust. And of course, as you it wouldn't surprise you to hear that the spending actually increased during the Great Recession. But there's also money to be made. You know, around half the ETF is animal health care. And one of the ways I sort of think about the space is fresh off of the debates and all the political stuff that's going on. I note the following. There's no Medicaid for dogs. You got to pay for that. There's some emerging insurance companies, but it's a place where there are margins, there's money to be made. So we thought the opportunity was there. We think this is, you know, a long-term, you know, opportunity. We think we did this right. In other words, we appropriately found companies that were, if you will, the pure plays, real pet care companies. You know, sometimes you see these themes like a blockchain idea, and it ends up being a bunch of financial services company. You're like, do I really get blockchain? Did I get something else? We think we really did it right. We think the opportunities for the firms are there. The right companies are in the ETF, and you know what? It's conversational alpha. You know, if you're a financial advisor and you're talking to your clients, it resonates because their pets are near and dear to their heart and they're spending so much money on them. It would be nice for them to make a little money off of the pet care industry as well.
I love this idea of conversational alpha. This is something that the Global X has talked about a little bit on the Trillions podcast that covers ETFs. And it's this kind of idea that you've got something to go to your clients and talk about that goes beyond the returns. So you're not just thinking about the return side of things. You're not just thinking about the strategy, but you're able to say, well, look, you know, you own a dog, you own a Labradoodle or a Golden Retriever. And it's something that people can like really identify with. And they can think about that in terms of how it might boost their portfolio.
Absolutely. So Simeon, you said there's money to be made. This is a long-term opportunity. But if I look at the market cap of the fund right now, it's roughly $56 million. I mean, how do you get over this hurdle? What is the conversation with investors to actually get people to want to come and invest in a product of this sort rather than just going to a broad market fund and have them zeroing in on one thematics, but also thematics surrounding the pet care space?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. So first, 56 is a nice viable size for an ETF. So, you know, we launched this a little bit over a year ago. So it's going in the right direction. But absolutely, these are, you know, satellites to a core investment portfolio. So, you know, if one were to have an appropriately structured long-term investment portfolio, you would indeed have this as an addition to a core holding. So nobody would be suggesting that your the core of your retirement fund should be in a pet care ETF. But it's going to it really has the opportunity to add alpha, to add diversification, and to add a little bit of extra juice to a core portfolio. And those are the conversations that we're having, and we think they're going pretty well. We're certainly looking to grow it, but it's been moving in the right direction since its launch.
You know, Simeon, as Sarah will tell you, the way I think about it, if I'm bullish on pets, I want to go triple levered paws.
He wants triple levered paws.
I want a triple levered paws.
Mike wants triple levered everything.
That's right. No, but I do want to sort of segue into that discussion because I know there's been some backlash, obviously, to leveraged ETFs. The SEC wants to sort of implement a system where brokerages have to sort of quiz clients on whether they're sophisticated enough to understand what's going on in leveraged and I suppose inverse ETFs as well. Could you sort of get us up to date on where that debate stands right now? I know the SEC is still accepting comments about this. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually not really the right person at the firm to talk about the current proposals. You know, what I can tell you, of course, is that leveraged and inverse ETFs have been around for quite a while and have been valuable tools for investors for both hedging positions in their portfolio, looking for opportunities where they have particular points of views that have been valuable tools. But unfortunately, I'm not the right person at the firm to be talking about the updates on what's going on with the proposal.
I can chime in on that. This is something that we've been following quite closely for a couple of years. This is kind of part of this long thought out derivatives proposal that the SEC has been mulling over for a while. They finally came out towards the end of last year with some proposals and a sort of carve out provision from the derivatives rule that would apply to leverage funds. And what they've kind of suggested is this kind of give with one hand, take with the other kind of approach, in that they are proposing lifting what has essentially been a moratorium on new issuers of leveraged products. So ProShares, for example, and its competitor Direction have been able to sell leveraged products, but we haven't seen any new issuers being able to come into the space since I think around 2010. So they're proposing lifting that moratorium. But the downside is that they do want these, from an issuer perspective, the downside is that they do want these greater controls at the point of sale. So for the brokerages that may be selling these leveraged products, they would have to ensure that the client has a certain degree of sophistication, that they have a certain number of assets, that they have a certain level of understanding before they are able to green light a sale of those products. So the SEC has been collecting comments on this. ProShares has been quite interesting in this space and that they did come out and encourage their shareholders to actually respond to the SEC and to give their thoughts on this process. But it's still something that's kind of ongoing, and the SEC has yet to come out with a final proposal.
You know, what I find interesting, Rachel, is if I want to, so the way I envision this is if I log on to my E-Trade or my, Ameritrade account, and I try to buy a levered ETF, I'll get some sort of pop-up saying you have to answer these questions. I don't And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the same is true if, say, I want to open a margin account or want to start short selling stocks over the same platform. So I wonder if, would that be a next step, do you think, that they would sort of start cracking down on that as well?
So there's an interesting thing with kind of purchasing leverage products already, in that you do sometimes have a few boxes to go through already without having these extra kind of provisions that the SEC is contemplating in place. You know, some people will have a box that you kind of have to tick, but there isn't, for an options based contract, you would have to actually get documents through the mail, sign them, fill them all in, send them back. There's no kind of level like that that applies for leverage products. And the argument goes that, you know, if you have products that have options embedded or other derivatives embedded, maybe there should be kind of a similar sort of process to ensure that you understand in the same way that there is for more complex purchases of derivatives. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how the SEC sort of goes from here, whether this is sort of the further edge of their kind of policy making, because let's remember, this is a proposal. This is not kind of written in stone. And these things, looking at what the different commissioners from the SEC have come out and said on this, there is clearly some division between the sort of Republican and Democrat leaning commissioners. And this is a bit of a dialogue. You know, it's a little bit of a give and take here. So I think it's hard to say at this stage whether things veer towards the, you know, increasing kind of client checks and that becoming more and more something we see expanded to other markets, or whether actually it kind of reins back and they find a middle ground where maybe we see a little bit more required, but not quite what's being contemplated at the moment.
So, Simeon, regardless of what's going on in the regulatory arena, some of the leveraged funds that you guys are well known for are the ProShares Ultra Pro Triple Qs, TQQQ, then there's the short version, SQQQ. Can you walk us through maybe how you typically see investors actually utilizing your products? And then from your perspective, as the head of investment strategy, how do you actually go about having conversations with investors as well about the right way to actually put them to use?
Yeah, I'll answer that in two parts, because one, with regards to the leverage ETFs and the leverage inverse ETFs, we have a ton of education on our website to help people think about how they can express different views and create portfolio constructions that make sense and use them in a way that will help them meet their objectives. But actually, myself and my team, we spend most of our time talking about our sort of, for us, traditional buy and hold strategies. In fact, our biggest ETF today, over $7 billion, is ticker NOBL, which is the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats ETF. So we talk about our suite of dividend growth ETFs more than just about anything else on the platform these days. And in fact, it's very applicable to the current environment, because companies that consistently grow their dividends have, you know, been a really nice way to be able to participate reasonably well when markets go up. But when you have a bad quarter like we had in 2018, the down capture, the defensiveness has worked very well as well. So that's been a really core part of our conversations with financial advisors and other clients for a little while now.
I love the name of that, the Aristocrats. What is it? You have to have grown your dividend for, is it 20 years going or something?
25 for the large cap. And we think, we also have ticker REGL, which is the S&P 400 Aristocrats, and SMDV, the small cap. And there's almost a little bit of an interesting, I don't want to say more per se, but certainly an interesting opportunity with mid and small caps, because as we know, large caps have run this market for a while, but it's perhaps even has been a bigger impact that people note. Over the last decade, on a price-to-book basis, mid- and small-cap stocks have gone from parity to the S&P 500 to trading at a 40% discount, 60 cents on the dollar. Now, the problem is there's a lot of junk when you get down there. But you resolve the junk problem if you invest in the dividend growers, the consistent dividend growers in mid and small. So, you know, we've been talking not just about the flagship NOBL, but also REGL in mid cap and SMDV in small, which resonates with folks. You know, you're looking at the tape and wondering, things keep going up, but I'm a little nervous. This is a nice alternative for that things keep going up, but I'm a little nervous state of mind.
But at the same time, I want to ask, because I feel like we've almost been in this state of mind for quite a while now, this idea that things keep going up, but I'm pretty nervous. And with that, we've heard multiple strategists, portfolio managers, many people I've spoken to saying, all right, so that means look at small caps, look at emerging markets, look elsewhere, don't look at U.S. large caps. But that just continues to be what keeps going up. And you would imagine maybe making people more nervous. I mean, is the solution really to keep going elsewhere? Even though it's been roughly, I guess, a year now over that since we had that correction in 2018, in which we did see this performance continue.
Yeah. So first, I'm kind of a classic asset allocation guy. So somewhere between 40 and 50% of your portfolio probably should be U.S. large caps or for U.S. investor. And if you love it, you have a little more. If you hate it, you have it a little less. And to put that in perspective, if you think about the valuations of large caps, I don't get too worked up because, and you've all heard this many times before, because how low interest rates are. You know, if you plot the PE of the S&P 500 against interest rates at a 2% 10-year, you get a 20 multiple. And we're now at 1.5 times, and we're at somewhere around a 20 multiple. And by the way, we're starting to have a little bit of earnings growth. In Q4, we had about 1% earnings growth for the S&P 500. But if you take out energy, you had actually over a 4% increase in earnings. That's the first time in 4 quarters. And I would argue it's a little bit of kind of this, you have to follow the bouncing ball, but it's an artifact of the corporate tax cut. The corporate tax cut temporarily boosted margins in 2018. But then for the large part of 2019, that started to be eroded in price, just like we learned in freshman economics. The tax cut went through price for a lot of companies that are price competitive. Where you don't have to anniversary it anymore using old retail speak. And in Q4, you started to see some earnings growth. So if you put that together, it's not a terribly bearish story for large caps, particularly when we're in this almost Goldilocks of 2% GDP growth. We have 2% GDP growth because we have a very strong consumer and a middling manufacturing sector. And that means the Fed can't do anything, but we're growing just enough. So I don't want to be I'm not a particular pessimist, such a pessimist on large cap that you should dump all your large cap and go into mid, small and emerging markets. But I would absolutely agree with the notion that, as I mentioned, there's a relative valuation opportunity in mid and small. And I'll pile on to the EM a little bit, too. One of the things that people, I think, aren't as familiar with regards to emerging market stocks, and by the way, we have ticker EMDV, which is our dividend grower in EM, as I do a ticker check because that's part of my job.
This guy's good at getting the plugs in.
I'm an ETF company, so I got to put tickers out there. That's what we do. So in emerging markets, the quality is actually higher than in developed markets. So in other words, margins and returns on assets and equities are actually higher in EM. We know that the virus is an overhang in EM. We also suspect there's stimulus coming along the way, not just from China, but look, we even might get a cut in the US, and that's always good for EM. And I think if we see some stability in commodity prices, I know that's a big if, people looking at oil, copper, and all that, there's an opportunity there. So I am on board with the notion that there's some relative value opportunities in things like mid, small, and EM, but I don't think valuations are that scary in core U.S. large cap equities either.
Now, Rachel, Simeon sounds fairly optimistic, but I know you were looking at some of the flows into the ProShares funds year to date. I got to say that the money coming into the ProShares does not look very optimistic. Tell us a little bit about what the flows look like to you.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to be a little bit careful when you look at leverage funds and flows, because you do see a lot of people kind of using these very much as get in, get out kind of trading vehicles. But there is a sign, you know, when you see a flow, it means that people need more shares, therefore more shares have been created because people want to use that fund. And we've been seeing a lot of that in SQQQ and in SH, which are two short funds, one against kind of the NASDAQ and one against the S&P 500. And that suggests to me that people are hedging themselves or betting against the current highs that we're seeing in the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. We are starting to see a little bit of signs that maybe we could see a slight pullback in stocks. There's been a couple of wobbles this week. So I think it'll be kind of interesting to see sort of whether those flows continue or whether we see a little bit of reversal if some of the kind of froth is taken out of the market.
Look, I mean, people, when the virus is creating volatility, and you know, people always look for hedges in times of volatility. It's quite well known that after just about every one of these pandemics, epidemics, viruses, you look 6 to 12 months out, the market's up. But in the short run, things can happen. You know, outside of the opportunities that you discussed with our vehicles, I also point out a classic old school hedge. You know, zero coupon bonds are up 13% year to date. The problem is with a 27, 28 duration, all we need is this to calm down and the 10-year goes back to 2% and you lost 12 or 13%. So that's something that that's old school a hedge right there, because yeah, if the virus you know, really kicks in, for all we know, you could see a further rally in treasuries. From our perspective, we think in the medium term, you know, the odds of anything are a little bit of you think of 2% on the 10-year as normalization, but I guess it would be directionally normalization at this point. We've actually got a couple of interest rate hedged corporate bond ETFs. IGHG is it's our investment grade flavor, and HYHG is high yield. And as we had a little bit of movement out in spreads, if you want to take advantage of that, but hedge out the treasury rate risk and just have the corporate piece, it's almost like credit arb light or a credit arb strategy in an index form. That's been something that people have been talking about.
So, Simeon, to get back to that idea of asset allocation, I think you said, 45% U.S. large caps. What does the rest of your portfolio look like?
Yeah, so then you have your slug of mid and small on the order of another 10 or 15 in small. If I don't add up because I'm not writing this down, don't hold it against me. You know, another 10% in 5 or 10% in small cap, and then something on the order of 20-odd percent in developed international and another 5 to 10% in emerging markets from a baseline standpoint. So the way the logic works, about half the world's equities are outside the U.S., but if you're a U.S. liability person, then you should probably have about U.S. dollar liability person. You have about 60% U.S. broken out pro rata by market cap, and then the international stuff about two-thirds developed, one-third emerging.
Hey, we're journalists. You don't have to worry about us doing math. We're not going to check your math.
You could take Mike for his
word.
It's,
yeah. There's one other opportunity that we've seen is sort of a quasi-sector opportunity that we've been talking a lot about that, and that's in the infrastructure space. I'll have to do another ticker because that's my job. But our ticker is TOLZ, another clever ticker because it's tolls, like a toll taker. The infrastructure sector, and we follow the Brookfield Index of owners and operators of the infrastructure assets. So in other words, not the sort of construction company and the drillers. These are the people who own the assets, for example, cell phone towers and airports and things like that. You're currently getting in that space 2 times the yield of the S&P 500 at only two-thirds the price to book, and you're actually getting 100 basis points more yield than utilities, which, you know, if bonds go up at all, you really got a problem there. So we think this is a clever space. Because you own the assets, you're making money even if there isn't the long-awaited infrastructure bill, and if there is one, you have a little bit of ticket to upside too. And a lot of people have been talking to us about that sort of quasi-sector opportunity in infrastructure. To get 4% yield in this environment is it's hard to do, even in bonds.
Right. A lot of politics talk, but it will be very interesting over the next couple of years if we do see both sides of the table come together for some type of infrastructure bill. But Mike, before we get to the craziest thing, Rachel, let's move into your new world of the currency space, because we have seen some crazy moves there. The dollar just continuing to outperform. It's pretty unbelievable. I'm pretty sure in the latest Bank of America fund managers survey, they said a net 54% of those surveyed said that the dollar is overvalued. I think many people have said this for quite a while now, but that's the second highest level since 2002. And at that, we've also seen just a complete breakdown in the yen against the US dollar. And this even as people are moving to safe havens, the like of gold, elsewhere too. What is it about this move in dollar yen that's so different and interesting right now?
Yeah, this is huge irony, isn't it, that we've got this massive kind of risk-off sentiment, and yet the yen is not doing what we would expect the yen to do as kind of a traditional safe haven. And I think there's kind of like a number of different factors that are really playing into to the yen's weakness there. You know, we've seen, obviously, as you mentioned, kind of this big dollar strength, and that's kind of a move that's been fairly sort of broad-based. If you look at some of the dollar indexes, they're pushing up on kind of significant levels. One of the the dollar indexes is looking at kind of the 100 handle, which is kind of seen as a sort of, you know, we love round numbers on this side of the table. But yeah, no, I think that is kind of an interesting level that people are watching. So there is this broad kind of strength. But I think when it comes to Japan, there is both fears that kind of some of the handling of the coronavirus, that the quarantining of that cruise ship there, and kind of whether there could be more of an outbreak sort of within Japan proper, whether that could kind of start to sort of pop up in the news over the next few days. There are signs, of course, there that the economy and growth is not going to be, you know, sort of heading in the right direction. And that seems to be another kind of thing that's weighing on Japan's sentiment. And then we are moving towards the end of the fiscal year over there as well. So there's a sense of reallocating sort of assets out of the yen and into into other currencies like the dollar, for example. You actually do see this crossing over into ETF land, just to bring it full circle, because we have seen there's a JP Morgan fund out there, BBJP, I can play tickers too, that kind of has been seeing big outflows.
But that's somebody else's ticker.
I know. I'm sorry. Have to broaden it out a little. But we've seen big outflows from that over the last couple of days, few weeks, really. That money seems to be potentially moving into a European-focused ETF. When you look at kind of the holders of both of those products, there's one big Goliath in the room. JP Morgan itself is a very large holder of these. And we do see kind of these sorts of products used by model portfolios and used to reallocate kind of money at home. But I think it's interesting that this is kind of a not just a sort of yen situation, but it's a kind of Japan situation. So it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of plays out over the next few days, particularly as we do see kind of, you know, this move into other types of havens. You know, we are seeing kind of the move into the dollar. That seems to be a favorite place. Gold, as you mentioned, and treasuries, you see that in the ETF space too. GLD do very well. TLT, which is longer term treasuries, also getting inflows.
Yeah, I thought it was surprised me when the coronavirus started breaking out and the yen was rallying on this haven demand, when the main risk is right in Asia. You know,
that's
the time when the yen stops working. And you look at the chart in 1998 and the Asian financial crisis, and it wasn't very strong then either. So
Japan has already been dealing with some of its own issues too at that. Yeah. Then you introduce the coronavirus. So
yeah. I think this is just I'm amazed that people look to currencies to hedge equity market exposure, because there's so many moving parts. You know, the better answer is either an explicit hedge or the zero coupon bonds. At least you know if that virus gets a heck of a lot worse that there's going to be a treasury rally. The odds of that, I shouldn't say with certainty, but the odds of that are much, much higher than trying to figure out if the yen's going to be the safe haven but the virus is on its shore. And that, to me, there's just too many moving parts there to use that as a hedge for other forms of risk in your portfolio.
Okay. Well, Simeon, there is no haven from the craziest thing we saw in markets. I don't know.
See what you did there, Mike.
I don't know if they warned you about this gimmick of ours, but every week we discuss the craziest things we've seen in markets this week. Oddly enough, I tend to see the craziest things. I'm just going to go out and say that, Sarah. I know that upsets you.
Mike thinks he wins every week, yeah. Simeon. Right. But there are a very, I would say, large group of people who would very much disagree.
Haters gonna hate.
You have some haters coming out. But first, I will say we did have someone weigh in on Twitter. But before we get to that, remember you can also give us a call at our very own Bloomberg Podcast hotline. Leave us a message, ask us questions, let us know about the craziest things that you guys have seen in markets, and we might even play your message on the show. So for that, the number is 646-324-3490. But we did get a good weigh-in on Twitter. This one came from @JYSquall. He said, when decentralized finance, parentheses, DeFi, discovers what flash loans are used for.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going to try to explain this one.
Go for it. This is a little wonky.
This is kind of like when dad makes dinner, though, so I might burn this and, you know, call the hotline if I got this wrong, but basically, he's talking about this outfit, BZX, which is sort of like a peer-to-peer type of lender, but with crypto. And happens to pretty much every crypto exchange eventually?
Gets hacked.
They get hacked. And this one got hacked to the tune of $645,000, which I think, as far as crypto hacks go, is pretty much small potatoes. But still a very interesting story. And we thank J.Y. Squall, if that indeed is your real name, we thank you for the contribution.
I have a feeling maybe it's not.
Yeah, maybe not. Rachel, do you have any crazy observations from this week?
Well, my crazy observation is one that you could probably have done last week as well. But I've been watching Tesla, because we saw that enormous crazy spike. And then it rained back in. Everyone was like, see, told you it was a bubble. And it's just been creeping higher and higher. And yesterday, we went to a new I don't think it was at quite the high, but we were back around that 950 level. So that to me is really fascinating. I know there was a lot of talk when we initially saw that spike about whether you could overlay the Tesla stock price with Bitcoin. And there was a lot of no, these are very, very different ideas. But seriously, try it. Yeah. It's a little bit scary.
Tesla is a perennial favorite of the craziest
thing
segments.
I've used it
in
the past couple of weeks. Right. We have a new price target this week of $928 a share within minutes, essentially. You have Tesla trading above $928 a share. I'll share my crazy thing because it's very much a compliment to Tesla. I've been living in this space lately. I've actually been working Asia hours to help out throughout the coronavirus. So my U.S. daylight hours to search for crazy things have been somewhat limited. But one that's been a clear favorite over the past week has been Virgin Galactic.
That's a good one.
Unbelievable. Similar space as Tesla. The ticker is SPCE, but similar space when it comes to movements. I mean, this is a stock that's now up 220% year to date, up 120% in February alone. So we're just seeing these odd, eccentric, crazy, steep moves across the stock market in very weird, not weird, but favorites.
That stock's going to the moon.
Punny.
That was a bad joke. Simeon, I know we booked you last minute, but did you have a chance to?
Oh, I came up with one.
Oh, excellent.
So this is a little old school.
Yeah.
And you have to say
so
it.
So am I. So I.
Yeah, you have to say it in measured tones because strategists always refer to this in measured tones. I've been watching the Baltic Dry Index.
Now you have to explain it in that voice the whole time.
Yes. The Baltic Dry Index. That's the dry container shipping index. It's down 80%. 80% from 2,500 to 500. What 2,500 means and 500 means, don't worry about it. But it's down 80%. And by the way, that is now the depths of the crisis level. So that's kind of nutty. Some people think it's a recession signal. It's obviously much more about the coronavirus and the immediate impact to some of the commodities markets. But that's huge. 80% is a big, big move. So I don't know if that would win me any prize, but it caught my eye.
I'll tell you what, Simeon. I like the Baltic Dry a lot. The only reason I will not award you a prize for that is that I that was one of my crazy things last week, I believe.
But you would have had no way of knowing.
Oh,
you would have had no way of knowing.
I listened to a couple of them quickly, but I didn't catch that one. So
that's okay. All right. Well, Mike set him up pretty strong. And I want to say before you get started, because Andres Ochoa on LinkedIn reached out and he said, Sarah, please make sure Mike sticks to finance-related topics when debating the craziest thing in markets. No more vintage bikes or like occurrences. So, Mike, you better stay honest.
All right. That's fair. That's a fair. LinkedIn, all of a sudden we're getting trolled on LinkedIn.
All over.
What is going on? Man, that'll teach me to post on LinkedIn, I got to say. But now I can reveal the winner of the craziest thing we saw in markets this week. And Sarah, with all honesty, Rachel, if you disagree that this is not the craziest thing, please speak up.
He's like handing Rachel a $10 bill underneath the table.
However, we've all heard of this company, Facebook, right? $600 billion market cap, one of the most important companies out there. So there's a new book out called Facebook, The Inside Story, written by a longtime technology journalist named Stephen Levy. There was a good review in it this week in Business Week. 600-page book on the history of Facebook. There's one line in this review buried deep inside the review that has caught fire on social media, in the press, even the New York Post. You know, if it shows up in the New York Post, it's a crazy thing. And it is this. Apparently, Mark Zuckerberg suffers from severe perspiration when he speaks at public events. So to eliminate the threat of armpit stains, he has an executive, they say, an executive, not just some intern, an executive in the communications department at Facebook comes and blow dries his armpits before public speeches.
blow dries with heat? Wouldn't that make it worse? Well, that's, or cool air?
That's the question. That's what I was wondering, because I kind of live in a glass house when it comes to heavy perspiration. You know, I think this is why our producer Topher always seats the guests on the opposite side of the table for me. I would assume that blow drying your pits
would make it worse.
Yeah, but maybe they put it on the cool setting.
That's what I'm thinking.
I don't know.
It's got to be on the cool setting.
Right. But I'm gonna. I guess I'll have to try it. I don't know. I might start blow drying my pits. But I don't think I can get an executive in the company to do it for me. I think, Mark, come on, man. You got to blow dry your own pits.
I think that's illegal these days.
Right. Exactly. I mean, how much do you have to get paid to blow dry another guy's armpits?
Well, if they're an executive, it's an important job.
That's true. Well,
it's a very important job.
Right. The chief officer in charge of dry armpits.
All right, Rachel, does Mike win?
I don't know. Would we say that's markets?
Well, yeah. Facebook is one of the most important stocks.
But did anything happen with Facebook stock?
You keep an eye on that share price.
All right. We will. And we'll blame sweaty pits. All right. With that, Simeon, thank you so much for joining us. And Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been a
pleasure. Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and Rachel Evans is at RachelEvans_NY. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.